TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The day we bombed Utah. From the beginning of the nuclear age, from the Manhattan Project to the bomb testing program, to the development of nuclear reactors, one aspect remained concealed. That is, the emission and the effects of radiation on life. And it was not a question whether scientists, government agencies, including the Atomic Energy Commission, were ignorant about the danger and the effects. Freedom of information requests reveal the evidence that they knew and decided to keep it secret or downplay it. And one can easily argue that the effects of radiation remain one of the deadly secrets of our time as well. Fallout from the atom bombs exploded on the Nevada test site affected most seriously communities of downwinders in Utah, but were also recorded 2,000 miles away on the East Coast. The author and investigative writer, John G. Fuller, unraveled the sequence of lies and deception to the downwinders of Utah in his book, The Day We Bombed Utah. In a pre-publication article in the May 1983 edition of Omni magazine, he previewed his most important points. Thanks to RT in Los Angeles for sending me the worn-out Xerox of this very hard-to-find article that reads as if it was written today. Post-Chernobyl and post-Fukushima. Fuller takes us to the sheep ranges of the high desert of Nevada and Utah. The Day We Bombed Utah by John G. Fuller. The night was quiet, except for the bells of the sheep. On the winter range, they were restless. It was mild that March night in 1953, a soft 49 degrees. Still, inside the snug sheep wagon, the wood stove took off the chill. Even before first light, Kern Bullock and his brother Mac would be saddling up their horses to nudge their band of nearly 2,000 Rambouillet sheep on the trail toward Utah, toward home. There wasn't more than 100 miles to go, from north of the Lincoln Mine in Nevada, trailing eastward along Tickaboo Valley, Dry Lake, and on home to Cedar City. Kern and Mac Bullock loved the range with a passion. The sheep traveled and grazed about 6 miles a day, grubbing their muzzles deep into the snowy and porous rocky soil, down to the roots of the black sage, saltbrush, and galita grass. The Bullock brothers were accustomed to the silence and loneliness of the Nevada range, but they could never get accustomed to the violent spurts of the atom bomb tests at Yucca Flat, just 40 miles away. Some of the test bombs would yield more than four times the kilotons of the bomb that had leveled Hiroshima 8 years before. The mushroom cloud, fiery and turbulent, would boil upward just before sunrise to create a false dawn. The Bullock horses would rear up, the sheep would scatter, and the dust cloud would sweep toward them, thick with dirt and fallout. There could be no harm, of course. Press releases from the Atomic Energy Commission, the AEC, stated that the fallout, quote, does not constitute a serious hazard to any living thing outside the test site. For some reason, the test shot that came in the pre-dawn of March 24, 1953, seemed different to Kern Bullock. The ground shook more. The sheep were more frenzied. Red, the sheepdog, jumped into the sheep wagon and cowered. The mushroom cloud, capped with a crest of ice crystals, soared to 40,000 feet above them. Kern covered his eyes. He thought he could see the bones through his clamped fingers. What neither Kern nor Mac Bullock realized at the time was that they were to become unwitting principals in a tragedy. At first, the cloud would pass over their herd. Then it would engulf hundreds of humans. The cloud would not dissipate in their lifetime. And despite years of strenuous government efforts to deny the tragedy, it hasn't ended today. As the cloud and dust from the March 24 detonation headed north from Yucca Flat and toward Bald Mountain near the Groom Mine, Bob Sheehan went down to one of the cabins to see if William Hawley, the radiation monitor from the Public Health Service, wanted to have some breakfast. Hawley wanted some, but he couldn't leave his radio and telephone equipment, which he had set up for the shot. There would be messages coming in from the other monitor posts to track the fallout. Hawley was occupied with a broken generator when the phone rang in the cabin. He asked Bob Sheehan to get the message. On the phone was Hawley's counterpart out near the Lincoln Mine. The radiation reading there and for the valley where the Bullocks were was very hot. A few miles from Lincoln Mine, the Bullock brothers, on horseback, herded up the stray sheep and watched as the dusty haze closed in. According to legend, on a clear day, you could see a train coming 2 days away. Today was nothing like that. But they could see a jeep speeding toward them on one of the few roads that cut through the desert. In the jeep were several men. They pulled up close to the Bullocks and got out, looking worried. They were wearing plastic boots. "You fellows are in a hell of a hot spot," they said. "You better get out of here fast." Kern Bullock asked, "How can we do that? The sheep move 6 miles a day." The answer was, "Move them as quick as you can. This is no place to hang around." Then the jeep drove away. The Bullocks had never heard of a radiation hotspot. The herdsmen did the only thing they could. They hustled their sheep east, away from the blast, toward Utah. Later that day, Bill Hawley filled in the Sheehans about the radio and phone calls. A report on a band of sheep and two sheep herders had come in. In the valley where the Bullocks were, the readings were hotter than at the Lincoln Mine. There was talk of sending a copter to get the two sheepmen out, but the Public Health Service monitors did not want to return to the spot. The decision was made at the Proving Ground control point to get the people at Lincoln Mine under cover. Nothing could be done about the two sheepmen. On the range, the Bullock brothers continued to trail the sheep home. The ewes were a month away from lambing now. By May, the lambing sheds at Cedar City, Utah would be full of hundreds of mother ewes. Approaching the Utah border a week after the test shot, the herd grazed every foot of the way, nibbling at the sparse vegetation, taking in mouthfuls of dirt and desert sand along with it. Mac Bullock, circling the rear of the herd on his horse, drew up to a ewe and saw she was about to give birth to a premature lamb. He dismounted to help her. When the lamb came out, it was stunted. There was no wool. It had a strange pot belly. There were no legs. But premature lambs on the trail were common. Mac Bullock shrugged it off. He did the same even when 8 more lambs dropped prematurely on the rough terrain of the range. Bullock had a fleeting thought. Could the long series of tests since 1951, 22 of them so far, have anything to do with this? He had no way of knowing. He was glad when they got to the lambing sheds in early April. By May, there would be no more immature lambs. The brothers stacked the feed mangers high with hay, grain, cotton cake, and bone meal, a rich diet needed after the rigors of the trail. Ken Bullock, stalking the feed manger one day, noticed one of the sheep in a peculiar position. Its head had dropped into the manger, its muzzle buried in the feed. It was motionless. He went to the sheep and tried to lift it by the wool on its back. The wool came off in his hand in an enormous clump. The sheep was dead. All around its nose and mouth, as well as on its ears, were scabby sores. Its hoofs were hardened. In a matter of days, the scene repeated itself. Sheep would stand as if in a stupor, then suddenly fall over dead. During shearing, wool would slide off the sheep's backs with a single push of the clippers. The brothers would come to the shed with their father in the morning to find 40 or 50 sheep lying dead by the mangers. The symptoms were always the same. The local veterinarian had never seen anything like it before. Neither had Stephen Brower, the agricultural agent for Iron County. When the lambing season peaked, the scenes were horrifying. The newborns would emerge, deformed and stunted, with no wool, and with flesh as pale and soft as a human's. They had tiny legs. You could see the heart beating through the flesh. The baby sheep tried to stand and fell over. The toll mounted quickly. Hundreds lay dead. But the scenes weren't confined to the Bullocks' lambing sheds. Some 17,000 sheep belonging to Cedar City herders had been on the Nevada range at the same time that season. Many of the herders began to experience the same trauma. Annie Corey and her 15-year-old daughter were covered with blood in the lambing sheds as they tried to save the lambs and ewes at birthing. Their herdsman locked himself in his sheep wagon because he couldn't face the sight of the piles of dead sheep. At the end of the long day, Mrs. Corey rushed her daughter home to clean up for the school prom. D. Evans, a sheep man from Parowan, Utah, cringed at the sight of the bulldozers as they raked the dead bodies of his sheep into piles and shallow graves. At the Cedar City sheds of the Clark family, young Bob Clark came home from high school to help his brother Ken stack dead lambs into piles of 300 each, then throw them on a flatbed truck. Doug Clark, the father, counted the dead and watched as the truck hauled away what he'd worked for all his life. Preliminary count of the losses for all the Cedar City herdsmen, 4,390. Nothing like this had happened in the history of the region. The name of that test shot on March 24, 1953 was Nancy. It was shot number 2 of the series known as Upshot Not Whole. Nancy packed power. She was 24 kilotons, about twice that of the Hiroshima bomb. She was fired at Yucca Flat as she sat in a cab atop a 300-foot steel tower, which was vaporized. Rain or snow had to be carefully monitored. Either could bring down tightly packed fallout in a concentrated lump. To fire or not to fire was never an easy decision. It took the test manager, test director, and an advisor panel of experts to decide. Though they could postpone a shot, the major plans and decisions were made by the AEC in Washington. The commissioners operated under uncommon pressure and a sense of urgency. Throughout the country, patriotism was rampant. If you were against nuclear testing, it was suggested that you might possibly be a communist. War was raging on the Korean Central Ridges. McCarthyism was spreading. Ike had been inaugurated. Stalin had died. But the Cold War was hot. The Soviet Union had just detonated its own nuclear device, and the American nuclear monopoly was broken. Tests in the Pacific were too expensive. They took too much time and travel. In spite of intense debate, Nevada was the tactical, if not the popular, choice. Shots like Nancy were not popular. Nancy had considerably exceeded the estimated yield. No one knew exactly why. The AEC's Dr. John Bueger, briefing the commissioners, said that some locations had been hit with as much as 10 rads, but added that only thinly populated areas had been affected. But then there was a sharp rainout at Troy, New York, from a subsequent upshot knothole shot on April 25. creating a hotspot a day later some 2,000 miles away. The commissioners talked about the chances that had to be taken to meet a tough test schedule. Later, reviewing the long sequence of detonations, Commissioner Thomas Murray summed up everything in an elegant double negative. "We must not let anything interfere with this series of tests. Nothing." End quote. The average American was confused about the tests and about radiation. What were rads? What were Röntgens? The exposure, often quoted in rads per hour, comes from the fallout fission products like strontium-90, cesium-137, or iodine-131, released at the time of the explosion. When these products rain down with a fallout, they emit the whole ghoulish family of alpha, beta, and gamma rays, which have little respect for living tissue. They can't be seen, heard, tasted, or smelled. Whether the fallout lands on Cedar City, Utah, or Troy, New York, it doesn't land in a smooth, even layer. It falls in unpredictable globs, like paint being splattered on a Jackson Pollock canvas, like summer squalls hitting in spots across a lake. As the sheepmen in Cedar City were reeling under the piles of dead sheep, nothing stopped the test shot on May 19, 1953, called Harry, or Dirty Harry, as it was later dubbed. The people of St. George, Utah, a town near the point where Arizona, Nevada, and Utah meet, followed their custom of greeting the shots from the nearby ridges of the Utah Mountains, or Sugarloaf. This was history in the making, and the AEC assured the citizens that they were very real participants. Your best action, an AEC booklet read, is not to be worried about fallout. The solemn word from the AEC was that fallout had never injured anyone inside or outside the proving ground boundaries. Teachers took their classes out in the pre-dawn dark to watch the flash and the mushroom, to listen for the boom rattling along the canyons, and to look in wonder at the power of the atom. On the morning of May 19, Elmer Pickett took his wife and children up to Sugarloaf. Like a Norman Rockwell family on the 4th of July, they watched as Dirty Harry went off at 4:05 a.m. over the test site some 120 miles to the west. The flash was not blinding, as Elmer thought it would be. It simply lit up the whole sky. A few minutes later, he felt the rumble in the ground. After daylight, the cloud came over, tumbling above and glowing in a strange, swirling pink. Arthur Bruhn, a husky outdoorsman and president of local Dixie College, watched it too, along with his geology class. His wife, Lorna, had seen other shots with her children, sitting on the tailgate of their station wagon, eating homemade cinnamon rolls and drinking hot chocolate. This day, she and the children stayed home as the geology group went in their place. At home, Lorna Bruhn felt the shock. When broad daylight arrived, the cloud seeped over the mountain range and spread out over the town. She was just about to go to work in the garden when her husband called from college. "Don't go out," he said, "and keep the children in. The cloud is coming our way." Ken Clark, one of the Cedar City sheepmen, had been out to his sheep camp that morning in the Escalante Valley. He was driving home in his truck when the cloud engulfed him. It moved along with the truck as he headed toward Cedar City. The dust particles smacked against the windshield and worked their way through cracks to cover his clothes with soot. 5 miles out of Cedar City, he came to a roadblock. A small group of men from the proving grounds operation stopped him. They moved a Geiger counter over the truck and Clark's clothes. "Radiation all over you," they said. "Call your wife." Have her bring some new clothes. Then come back here. They gave him the name of a service station and told him to get the truck washed at their expense and then to return to the roadblock. He did. He noticed that the attendant washed the car with his bare hands. He wondered where the radiation went when it was hosed off the truck. When his wife brought new clothes, the men burned the old. Then they made him bathe in a watering trough. Clark wondered what was going on. First the horrible sights at the lambing sheds, now this. Roughly 5 hours after the Dirty Harry detonation, Frank Butrico, an off-site monitor for the proving ground, had his hands full. At 7:50 a.m., the radio message from Control Point instructed him to set up a roadblock at the intersection of Highways 18 and 91 near St. George. No cars were to pass to the west. A decontamination station was set up at the Utah Oil Service station on Main Street. By 8:45, the number of cars needing decontamination began to rise. The radiation reading did the same, moving from 1.8 to 3.2 rads an hour. Two Texaco stations were added as decontamination posts. By 9:10, high readings were found both in and out of the cars. However, the peak had not yet been reached. The decontamination operation was stopped, so was the monitoring. Motorists were ordered to stand by for 20 minutes to an hour. At 9:25, the test site control point radioed to tell all the people of St. George to take cover. Schools were ordered to keep the children inside during recess. By 9:40, nearly all of St. George was under cover. The radiation peaked at 5.2 rads, well over the permissible limit. 200 cars sat at the roadblock. Around 11, traffic was allowed to move, one car at a time. Dismissed from the classrooms, children ran out to play in the grass. More than 16,000 people had been caught in the fallout area. In the aftermath of the Dirty Harry shot, Butrico gave his appraisal. The events point up the need for educating the people in a 200-mile radius of the proving grounds, he wrote. Most of them are not aware of the precautions being taken to safeguard them, end quote. One of the safeguards Butrico took was to collect samples of milk in the area. He did it quietly to avert panic. With fallout came iodine-131, among other deadly fission products. Deposited on pastures and gardens, it entered the food chain. Most lethal, the dose to the thyroids of infants and young children. It could also attack the thyroids of the sheep and lambs that were still dying in Cedar City at the time of the Dirty Harry shot. Less than 2 months after the Nancy detonation, there had been 6 other test shots in between. A.C. Johnson, the elderly local vet at Cedar City, could do nothing as the sheep continued to die. Medication and force feeding were useless. The first team of Atomic Energy Commission veterinarians didn't arrive until June 5, some 10 weeks after Nancy and 2 weeks after Dirty Harry. By that time, only a few piles of dried bones of the stricken sheep were left. The vets were concerned and solicitous. Brouwer joined both Dr. Robert Tomsett from AEC Los Alamos and Dr. Robert Veenstra from a U.S. Navy base in San Francisco, as they went to the first sheds to examine the surviving sheep. When the team examined the first lamb on the underside of its neck, the radiation meters went off the scale. "This is hotter than a pistol," Tomsett said. The needle tried to go past the post. He scraped off one of the hard, scabby lesions that covered the mouth, nose, and head, and he handed it to Brouwer. just like the ones at Trinity, Tompsett said. Heavy radiation damage. He was referring to the livestock badly scarred by beta burns after the first A-bomb had been exploded in New Mexico in 1945. Veenstra took further readings. They were consistently high along the backs of the sheep. Brouwer asked all the doctors in the AEC group if he could get a copy of their official studies. They agreed. Meanwhile, the medical men wrote their reports. Dr. Veenstra wrote, "The location of the lesions and the nature of the sheep to nibble grass short leads one to suspect that the lips and foreface could easily come in contact with material on bushes, grass, etc., that would cause these lesions. It is my opinion that radiation was at least a contributing factor to the loss of these animals." And Dr. Tompsett reported, "Examination of these lesions leaves little doubt as to their origin, a diagnosis of radioactivity damage." End quote. The others on the preliminary team concurred. None could find any convincing alternate cause. But there was a major problem. Neither the sheepman nor the county agent Brouwer was informed of these results. Instead, a long series of machinations began behind the AEC's closed doors. The AEC cover-up remained hidden for almost three decades, until it was revealed in congressional hearings and an extraordinary court decision. Today, court documents tell the story that the government hoped would never come to light. That was the first half of a one-hour reading from The Day We Bombed Utah by John G. Fuller, published in Omni magazine in May 1983. Come back for the story, how the arrival of the fallout cloud changed forever the lives of the people of St. George, Utah. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information on how to order a CD of the reading of John G. Fuller's The Day We Bombed Utah by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation, CD or DVD order, keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.